KZSU Stanford, 90.1 FM. I'm Mark Bono. This is the Henry George Program, show all about land, policy, and politics. Today in the program, it is the second half of the Eric Goldman Transit Costs episode. Listen to part one if you haven't already. On this episode, we get into more of the structure and complications of public-private partnerships. Talk about risk management and how it's coordinated inside of that. We drill down into one case study, what's going on at the California High-Speed Rail, Shafter, California, and the very expensive infrastructure built there. And we talk some about public ownership of right-of-way. So without further ado, let's get into it and pick up right where we left off. Part four, I think, is perhaps the most interesting thing to get into, which is, I think, how risk is managed, how the public sphere and the private sphere is coordinated. And I think it's... Again, I think it's people can, I think, go to one, you know, one extreme or the other, but in practice across the world, you kind of mixed arrangements of private firms, public agencies, or public agencies with private characteristics and vice versa need to exist out there. And it's almost as though we have the worst of all worlds or something of like, we certainly don't do the public sphere what it needs to do, which is to, I guess, to bestow wisdom and guidance and to, I guess, have the proper muscles as opposed to, you know, is the tail wagging the dog? You have numbers about how the California High-Speed Rail project was just overrun with contractors to begin with. But I guess speak a bit about, you know, kind of, you know, the privatization of risk and, you know, what this means for these projects.
Yeah. So I think the big thing, and this goes back to the comment you made about, you know, novel agencies. And so when you are doing something that is new, you know, in terms of a project or as an agency, that culture is not there. You don't necessarily know what you're doing. And so you very understandably are going to say, hey, let's ask some experts to help us out. I think on transit, you know, the MTA, like that's, I mean, we've had subway in this city for over 100 years. Like our agent, I mean, the MTA has not existed for 100 years, but, you know, like we should know what we're doing. We have expansion plans. We're spending, you know, billions of dollars a year, or we'd like to be spending billions of dollars a year on these projects. Like having a staff that knows its stuff and is not overextended should not be controversial. Now, outside of New York, you know, LA Metro, Sound Transit, that has decades of projects in the pipeline, should not be controversial that they are staffing up internally and saying, you know, we want to own these projects and we want to manage them. We want to design them. We need consultants to help us with the specialties, right? Like it would be crazy for a transit agency to have like, you know, a tunnel engineer or many tunnel engineers on staff, right? Because like you're just not building that many tunnels. But you'd like the people on your staff to like know a little bit about what's going on, and maybe they can do some of the construction management. And right now, you know, I'm thinking of like the Link 21 project in your neck of the woods. You know, I think it's just like, it's a very vague project as I understand it, but it's you know, like dozens of consultants sort of like trying to figure it out with not the greatest of guidance as far as I can tell. And I think, right, like the only way we can guide projects, and this gets into something called project definition, is if we know what we're doing and we know what we want, and we can say very clearly, you know, we're building a transit line, high speed rail line between points A and point B. It's using this technology, these standards, you know, stations will be dot, 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 dot. We're using these systems. Okay. Now within those parameters, consultants like find me things that will make me go faster or save me some money. But I'm keeping you within these tight parameters. You know, you talked about risk. And I think the reason why we put risk in this category is that so much of the decisions about procurement are about offloading risk. And I think the theory really is we don't really know what we're doing. Let's hire these people. Let's get them to agree to a price. And then we'll check back in 5 years and see what's going on. And just unfortunately, you can't manage a project like that. Like all the places that deliver stuff either quickly or inexpensively or all both of those things, you know, it's like they have to manage these projects very carefully. And you have subject matter experts managing those contracts. And so like they have consultants in Spain or in France or in other places. They tend to be these sort of publicly owned entities So they're sort of they have the qualities of a private company, but they are sort of public. They're publicly owned, and so like we don't have we just don't have those. We Amtrak is a public benefit corporation, but like in Spain, they have a couple different. They have several. In China, everything is essentially a public benefit corporation, I guess. And that's why I think the cachet of being a public sector engineer is much higher internationally than it is domestically. The pay differentials are also different, right? Like American wages are spectacular, right? Like being a private sector engineer is like really quite lucrative. Being a public sector engineer is good, but it's like you're not revered as being anything special, and you are being underpaid certainly. But I think at the core of this section, there's a quote in here from a consultant working on one of these projects, who I think I will get the quote right when I say it. He said, "The mentality of the project sponsor has to be that the consultant works for me, not instead of me." And I think, that point I was making about, we'll check in on 5 years, is that you have this mentality of they're doing my work. They're doing the things that, I should be doing. And it could be a product of like I'm inexperienced, or I have just like a lot of other stuff I have to manage. And so you're not sort of guiding them, like as a anyone who has a management background, like managing people and work is like really hard and like takes a lot of time and effort. It's not something where you're just kind of like, okay, go do this thing. I'll talk to you in a couple months and see what happens. Like, I mean, that's just not good management. And so I think, like that sentence in particular to me sort of like sums up like all of the stuff in like a really profound way. Like that section needs to be both, 10 times longer than it is, but also could have just been that sentence, in some way.
I guess my personal history of like, I just find public-private partnerships such an interesting kind of history of governance and so much more. And I just like, it has to do with the neoliberal turn. But
Sure.
I think to understand the motivation, because to me, I guess the motivation seems to be there were some contingent factors such as kind of urban fiscal crises due to population issues. But on top of it, there were legitimate governance issues. There were
Yeah,
things like
absolutely.
pension issues of kind of unaccounted for future obligations, and I think just kind of a long-standing issue of local political machines using civil service as a way to kind of put everyone's cousin on the payroll, and sometimes this works. I mean, a lot of times this works. I think it's overstated, how a little bit of graft is the worst thing in the world. But I think, yeah, the promise of public-private partnerships, as I always hear it said, is that like it will deliver efficiency, it will deliver cost savings. And it seems like that still goes on to this day as kind of a truism that is at
Right.
least largely unbacked up by reality, as certainly if you don't do it right. If you say, if you have the right amount of design and then bid, or design and build with a proper amount of oversight, that competition, perhaps, in when structured right, will deliver efficiencies and savings. But if you get to it early, that you allow weird bloat and I guess you might call regulatory capture by these firms. I mean, one thing is kind of a stupid question. Like cost plus contracts seem like the incentive structure is so clearly off insofar as, it's there's no real penalties of people. I don't know. It's like it seems to
You
me it's
want to
like,
spend as much time as possible doing the thing because your
yeah.
costs are covered.
Yeah, exactly. I guess clearly people see the issues with this, but it still goes on as a standard. And I suppose when it's a mega project, I mean, like in New York City, I think like the whole Long Island Railroad to Grand Central or whatever. I
Yeah,
mean,
East Side
the
Access.
yeah, exactly. The Tudor Perini. Like, it seems like was that a case of the design was picked up by the contractors, and is that a big part of the bloat in that case?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, on that project, one of my sort of favorite stories going back to project definition is the engineering firm, the design and engineering firm, maybe it was WSP, I don't remember. they spent like a year or two working out the design that would bring in the Long Island Railroad trains to the lower level of Grand Central. And, you know, it's like, I mean, you're an engineer, so I don't need to tell you, but like working all that out is like labor intensive, and it costs, you know, probably tens of millions of dollars to like do all that work. And then when they presented it, and they were like, oh, actually, we want to have separate facilities for these two railroads. So like this work is nice, but you need to start over. And it's like, guy, you should have told us that at the jump. You know, it's like making us, you know, it's like sending us down these rabbit holes. I think that's the other side of the consultant piece, where because you're not, you don't have that project definition, or that definition changes, which is what happened in this instance, you spend a lot of time producing just like, you know, shelf art, as they say. And, you know, like, you know, that again, accountability on that would be like, whoever was the person was like, you know what, let's change, you know, let's, you know, change our design philosophy after they've done the design work, probably should be fired. Or, you know, the person who started that should have been, you know, like, you get the point. And so, you know, so I think, you know, that to that specific point is a big problem. But the initial question, I you because you East Side Access is like a
Yeah, which
whole
is just
thing
kind of, I guess,
that's very interesting.
the history and motivation of
Oh,
public-private
yes,
in the
right.
efficiency
So
gains or lack thereof.
yeah, so I think, you know, it's a really great point, is that I think the private sector is better at delivering things where there is sort of like a secret, right? So like the Google algorithm, let's say, right? Like, not everyone can come up with that. Like, I mean, maybe now, whatever, I don't know. But like, that is like a proprietary advantage. And so the private sector has the incentive to figure out some of that stuff. But like delivering a subway or a high speed rail, like, there's no secret. You know, it's like, this is not
We
like
know
all of
what
a
we
sudden,
want.
we're not going to be like, oh, there's this like uranium based train that like no one knows about that is, you know, we're going to deliver. It's like, no, we're just copying what like a bunch of other people have done. And why a public sector entity can't do that as effectively as a private sector entity is like, you know, I think that's like a stretch of an argument. I agree with you that I don't think the data backs up the claims of efficiency. I think what we found, we did a case study in our transit work in Italy where we did look at some public-private and design builds and design bid builds and different procurements. And we found that the performance was pretty similar. And the reason for that, at least that we thought, was this entity, Metropolitana Milanese, was sort of in charge of all the different projects, right? So you had like a really competent project manager who could work with whatever, because like you had good people who know what they're doing. And so, fine, deliver it this way, deliver it that way. It doesn't really matter. We're going to do a good job because like we're good at our job. If you are not good at your job, or you don't know what you're doing exactly, right, you can like come up with all the different procurements, progressive design build, alliance modeling, integrated delivery, design bid build, construction manager at risk, you know, whatever, cost plus. None of them will work well. Like, you know, it's like putting lipstick on a pig, as they say. And I think when you look at sort of, you know, the vogue right now is like Brightline is proving the private sector opponents correct. My response to that is, I love Brightline. I'm very excited about Brightline West. I think Brightline in Florida is wonderful. But like, you know, Brightline in Florida was delayed, you know, over budget and over schedule, not like a smashing success in that regard. Brightline West has not been delivered, so like we need to calm. I mean, I'm optimistic and I hope it all works out, but we don't know. And I think some of the design choices that they've made, which are saving costs, are not the choices that someone who is like, I'm trying to deliver the best project that will have operational flexibility. And like, you know, we can talk about like how much operational flexibility do you need, but like there's single tracking portions of that. And, you know, it's in the median of a highway, which means that you cannot run at 180 or 220 miles per hour on turns because the turns need to be much larger than the right of way. And so like they've made these decisions that are perhaps economically, you know, that will bring down the cost, but are not optimal from a transportation point of view. And so I think it's just worth being clear about that. Like there are significant differences in what they're doing versus what a California high-speed rail is doing.
And a lot of those choices, or you know, the path they're on, is a reflection of the fact it is using public rights of way to an extent. There's some degrees. It's a private firm, but it has kind of public aspects in some ways. It's almost like a franchise.
Oh, absolutely right. Sure.
Like the old franchise model of kind of like streetcars. They're
yes,
like
right.
They're a regulated monopoly by a city mm-hmm. that's sent off to private firms, but overseen. That's pretty appealing in some ways. You get you
absolutely.
Know there's accountability or hunger and some sort of independence. But yeah, it's not like some fresh-eyed businessman shows up and just has a good idea. Like it's very hard if you don't have these. Resources, I suppose. And, you know, I think all the issues of resources do come in with transit projects in no small way. They don't exist
yeah,
in the cloud.
And like the Brightline team, you know, where they've been really smart, you know, I've talked a little bit with them. I was on a panel with Mike Reniger, who's the head of Brightline. And we were talking about sort of the permitting issue, which comes into the next recommendation. And he's like, that's complicated. We've decided to solve a much simpler problem. And that's why, you know, we're not dealing with any of that stuff. We're in the median of a highway. Nevada and California want this. You know, when you look at like their environmental assessment, you can see how many comments there were. And I think there were 20 or something like that. It's a very small number.
Yeah.
And you look at like Texas Central, also a privately led project, but much more contentious. There's like 25,000 comments. Like all the California high rails, they've broken up their environmental into like a billion different documents. But those documents have, you know, hundreds and thousands, hundreds or thousands of comments. And, you know, the Brightline West, you know, they really have optimized for minimizing interlopers from, you know, slowing things down and monkeying with the mechanics of it.
And I suppose, yeah, that goes the last section of, you know, I guess you talk about environmental review, permitting, things that kind of at least, I suppose they regulate externalities of what you're doing to prevent issues arising from your project. But there's kind of a meta problem of when you create a framework to regulate the externalities, it's how you design this regulation framework. And if you don't regulate it correctly, there like I guess there are externalities. For example, there are issues running in the middle of a highway. It's, you know, at once it's you know, you could say it's aesthetically unpleasant for people using it. It's slower as far as it goes. It's a less of a quality project, and a lot of these environmental reviews and so on will have the deadweight cost of we don't get anything. We get stagnation. We get a lack of transit. We get car dependence because of these processes. I don't know, it's kind of how you build the guardrails or something, but yeah, it's not surprising that, you know, you see Brightline choose the path of least resistance and get something which is workable but also flawed in different ways. And I guess if you talk about reforms, it's, you know, you have to be cognizant of, you know, this is how you incubate the creatures you want in the future or whatever, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think that sort of to close out on the risk piece too, is that when you are doing a public-private partnership where so with in transit, the way these public-private partnerships really work is not the way Brightline works. You know, the public entity is going to own the project and they're going to pay an availability fee to the contractor who built the thing. And so as long as you're operating it, like we'll shovel a bunch of money your way. And so like the private entity takes on no risk, right? Like we're covering all their risks.
Yeah.
Whereas Brightline and Brightline West are going to take on farebox risk, which I think is very interesting and is a distinction that really should be, you know, highlighted. Because the reality is, if you look at like the Purple Line in Maryland, or we did a case study on the Green Line extension in Massachusetts, is that when these alternative procurements go belly up for whatever the reason is, we don't just walk away from the project. You know, like we don't say, okay, like it ate up all this money and, you know, it was too risky, so we're just going to stop. What we do is we figure out, okay, we'll just get a bunch more money and we'll like restart the project.
Yeah.
And that deadweight cost that you alluded to just earlier, like too bad, like that's just life. And like in our Green Line, we did a case on a Green Line extension in Massachusetts. And I believe that they used what's known as CMGC, construction manager, general contractor, as their procurement initially. and they were so unhappy, they killed the project. I think it was like $700 million in sunk costs. 200 of that was in rolling stock, so that it was a sunk cost, but is productive. So they ended up rebooting the project as a design build, but you had this $500 million of sort of unproductive money that was like on its balance sheet. The Purple Line in Maryland, I don't remember all the details, but I think they paid $200 million to the design builder to just walk away from the project. So again, that's unproductive money. And then they've rebooted it with, different players. But the point is that like the public sector doesn't just walk away from these projects the way that the private sector might. And I think as long as like that's the reality, like this fiction of, oh, we got to get the private sector in there to do whatever they're doing is like, we're not operating by the same rules. We're not going to do the same things that they're doing. So like, what the hell are we talking about? Like we should be innovative, we should be lean, we should like those should be values. I get, the criticism that like the incentives aren't necessarily aligned for that, and I accept that. But that's where I think like leadership is really important, and accountability then is really important. Like if you have a CEO who is stressing those values and is saying, I will replace you if you're not living up to the standards, and we could talk, and you get into like work rules and other things that make that harder. But then we should address those issues because like that's where the problems are, not in some fancy procurement strategy that doesn't work properly or whatever. Like we need to get upstream of some of this stuff.
Although, yeah, I guess it's upstream, but it's also part of the details. I mean, when you talk about early design, would like the Purple Line case and other cases where it's kind of running into one wall after another, would a certain percentage of early design that's done properly have prevented it? Or some like I don't know exactly how little design was done in these cases.
Well, so with Purple Line in particular, there were a couple of different things that sort of messed up that project. There was a judge who vacated the record of decision for its environmental clearance, and so that created delay. If I'm not mistaken, Maryland changed its water retention policies, so it went from I don't really know to then whatever the mitigation was to then like a much more you needed to build a much more expensive
Oh.
retention pond, and this was like hundreds of millions of dollars. And then I think the other big piece was that CSX, the freight railroad, was just very hard to get them to agree to anything, and they're like, you need to build a crash wall that's going to cost you, I forget the number, $20 or $50 million, something like that. And it's like those items sort of created so much delay and so much uncertainty that I think in the contract that the design builder signed is that if there was 180 days of the project not advancing, like they could walk away. And so they exercised that option. MTA Maryland took them to court, being like, no, you can't walk away. And the judge was like, actually, it says they can walk away. Give them their $200 million. And so, how you address some of that stuff, right, is yeah, you can't change standards middle of the project. Like you have to allow, like, and usually this is the case. Like once you get in your final design, like you vest this, like let's say we finish designing something today in 2024. It's like, okay, we're working with the standards of 2024. We're not now going to change everything in 2026 or 2028 just because everything, the world has changed. But like that also gets to the point of like the need to move more quickly
Yeah.
is that like the longer you wait around, the more stuff changes. And like things should change over time. Like in our New York case study, on Second Avenue, one thing that we talked about is like, the city put in bus rapid transit, select bus service, we call it. And that meant you need to have these electronic boards and there need to be like utility work in the sidewalks. Yeah, like the city should do that stuff. They wanted new streetlights, like all these things, like LEDs, and like the world should keep moving forward. But like if it takes you 10 years to do anything, like, like you're going to have just like leaps and bounds of change. You're going to have a lot of change. And so if you can't keep up and deliver a project quickly, you are more likely to be prone to like that kind of expensive change midstream. And I think again, that should be motivation to do things a bit more quickly as well. But then also in fairness, I do think city agencies should be, coordinating and say, hey, you're ripping up the street. Like, yeah, we should change our sewers, or, we should get involved and like do the things that we think are better. And in the section that we're talking about, there's an example about grade crossings in the city of Shafter. And there are these six BNSF grade crossings that are parallel. And the word parallel is very important to the California High Speed Rail right of way. And the city of Shafter sued California High Speed Rail because it was not going to build grade crossings, grade separations, excuse me, for the BNSF, even though BNSF's right of way is parallel. It doesn't intersect. And so has really nothing to do with California High Speed Rail's project, in my opinion, or I think any sensible person's opinion. And so they sued, and it took 4 years to resolve this lawsuit. It was eventually withdrawn because California High Speed Rail said, you know what? We're going to just pay for these six parallel grade crossings, and it's going to cost $200 or $300 million. We'll eat it because, no one is helping us here. The governor is not saying this is crazy. And they ended up getting a federal grant a couple of years later that's covering most of the cost. But the point is that these local entities, and we talked about this at the outset, they have a lot of power. And if they're, to your point about the regulations, like if they are framed in such a way where everyone is an equal, then, you can say, I'm not going to give you a permit to shut down my street unless you do X, Y, or Z, unless you build these grade crossings. I'm not going to give you a permit to relocate a sewer because you need to like dig underground until you agree to build the grade separation. I'm not going to, the electric utility, which is a big issue in high speed in the first contract, CP1, like PG&E and AT&T, like we're not going to do any of the utility relocation work for you. Like you just have to do it and pay for it. And it wasn't in your budget. Tough. Like it's going to be an extra $400 million for you. Like, I don't care. So, like I think there needs to there I don't think there's a lot of focus on this topic in particular. I think in doing the transit work and the high speed rail work, this is like critically important to me. Like this is to me the most exciting stuff. And I think where you see advances on these issues, I think the Canadians have done some interesting things. Specifically, we highlighted in Toronto and in Montreal, so in Ontario, in the provinces of Ontario and Quebec. In Ontario, they gave Metrolinx, the constructor of transportation services, master permitting authority within 50 feet of its right of way. And it's in its sort of planned right of way because like it doesn't exist currently. And so what that meant or what that means is that if someone wants to build something within that right of way, they need to get an approval from Metrolinx. And so there's a project in Seattle where I've done some work where this, I think it's in the town of Bothell, they Sound Transit said, we're going to build a station in this location. And the town of Bothell decided, you know what? We're going to build our new city hall in that exact location. And because Sound Transit doesn't have any control, they couldn't say, no, you can't do that. But in the Canadian example of Metrolinx would have been like, we're not going to give you a permit to do that, so you cannot do that. And like that allows them to protect the right of way and, sort of like move things along in a more sort of expeditious manner. The other example is in Quebec, La REM, which is an automated light rail, automated light metro, I should say. I'm get screamed at now. They put in sort of clear timelines, which I think is like, oh, I love this. Like operationalizing time, I think is critical. And so what they said here is that if La REM gets you, and this is like the equivalent of a city DOT, let's say, their drawings, their schedule, all of the like right documentation for you to like understand what they're doing, you have 60 days to respond. If you don't respond in 60 days, the project moves forward. And like they don't need to get a permit from you. And like again, this is abstracted up a level to the province that has power over the municipality. So I think equivalently that would be like saying the state of California has power over the city of Shafter to say, figure this stuff out or the project moves forward. And what's critical to understand is when you look internationally at high speed rail projects in particular, this is true in Spain, in Germany, in France, in Italy, as far as I can figure out. Every place I was able to talk to people about this, once the national high speed rail plan is approved, local planning has to adapt to the national plan. And I think, we were talking about these projects are the most expensive projects in states or cities' as histories. They are clearly of state significance, I would argue national significance, and they should be treated as such. And it shouldn't be that the city of Shafter, which has a legitimate issue with grade separations that should be addressed. The sixth grade separations are on the state's priority list for grade separations. It's like it's in Shafter's capital plan to deal with these grade separations. So it's obviously a long-standing important issue, but like they shouldn't be slowing down this project with their local concerns, because these projects are bigger than any one individual locality. And I think there are lots of examples within California High Speed Rail where this kind of thing happens. I actually recently received the renderings for what these grade separations are going to look like, and they're not shared, right? So they're going to be basically two great walls of China running down Central Avenue in Shafter, separated by, I don't know, 50 feet or whatever it is for BNSF on one right of way and California High Speed Rail on the other. And, I don't know how tall they are, but I think the highway standard for any overpass is like 15, 16 feet. So we're talking at a minimum, probably 16 feet is going to be, these two walls. Just, I mean, talk about just a disaster from a design point of view and like walkability and revitalizing a neighborhood or whatever. It's like now you're just in the shadows of these two great, just
And part
like.
of it, you don't need to grade separate the BNSF, right? Because they're living without it right now. It's not like.
Right. They are living with it right now. I think grade separations are good. It's like a good thing to do. It's just like, is it the responsibility of California High Speed Rail? Like, absolutely not. If like you're willing to live with this free California High Speed Rail, like nothing has changed. California High Speed Rail is coming in, grade separating itself and saying, we're not gonna, hit anyone the way that some of these other projects do. Like, we're gonna be safe. We're gonna be in our dedicated right of way. And it's just like, when I so I've never been to Shafter, and I don't know that I could point to it on a map, but I've done a lot of Google tourism, and I remember I found a mural in Shafter, and it has like a stylized, Santa Fe train like running through the town. And it's kind of like they love their train, it's like, or someone loved their train.
I just think, like, you talk about the externalities, and I suppose, like, grade separations, it kind of is, it's what do you take as normative and what do you take as
Yes.
departure from normative. And
Yes. Right.
I suppose to me, it's kind of galling that we treat what is essentially a primitive road crossing. Like, roads are, everyone's going 25 miles an hour. Who cares? It's like, this should be the standard. And if you depart from that,
Yeah.
okay, buddy, that's your, and you have to bring everything up to snuff. So we have, like, Shafter gets these, kind of space-aged roads to match the space-aged train network. A different system. I mean, the Caltrain electrification project,
Yep.
this again changes stuff. It changes stuff in the primitive of, oh sure, just cross at grade, to we now need separated grade crossings. And what's nice here is because of the ownership structure of Caltrain in the right of way, who is responsible? It's not Caltrain. So
Right.
every city has to determine basically, is this worth it or not?
Right, exactly.
In Palo Alto, there's a dippy little street called Churchill. You can go up 4 blocks, cross there. You can go down 4 blocks, cross there. Do you need to cross to Churchill? Well, that's an open question. I think, it's up to Palo Alto to say, with perhaps some grants, I don't think that's even justified, but what do we want to do about this? I would say you could shut it
Right.
off. You could have a cheap pedestrian bike
Right.
underpass, or
Right.
you could build a road. In my mind, honestly, if the roads are so damn important, I think perhaps you should fund the crossing through tolls. If
Right.
back in Shafter,
Yeah.
if Shafter is really so important that you need to cross the road, okay, you can fund this through tolls. I don't know. But if not, maybe these primitive road structures are not that important or something. That might be elitist and coastal of me, but, like, I don't know. Like, it's a very weird way for our investment funds to leak out is for these sorts of road upgrades.
Yeah, I think the other thing is that who derives the benefits, right? BNSF derives benefits.
Yes.
The drivers and Shafter derive benefits. Pedestrians derive benefits. California High Speed Rail does not derive any benefit from this. That's the other side of this. And it's sort of whoever derives the benefits should be at least have some skin in this game. And I think, right, we can have a discussion and say, you know what? We don't want to pay for this great separation. Screw it. We're not going to do it. Or, there are other design solutions to some of this stuff. I don't want to pretend I'm so steeped in the road network of Shafter. But you could close things off. You could, you could do a couple different things. Maybe you could reroute some of the traffic. I don't know.
Yeah.
Although I guess it's crossing. Eventually you do have to deal with it in some way. But again, 6 grade crossings, $300 million. It just seems like that money maybe is well spent. I'm not sure that California High Speed Rail, I know California High Speed Rail should not be the entity that is responsible for that. And the other side of it, which I get into in the report is that they did what's known as a locally generated alternative, meaning they worked with, I think it's in the Bakersfield, section of the project. They worked with the city of Bakersfield on designing this, right? They worked with the community to come up with this design, and what happens? They get sued. And it's just you gotta be kidding me. They are jumping through every hoop to satisfy this public process, and you're still not good enough.
Yeah.
And that's where again, you need a governor and a state legislature that is saying, you know what? They've made a real effort here. We cannot keep doing this and shooting ourselves in the foot.
You could create the right framework that indemnifies them against this back end if they do the right process, but we get the worst of both worlds, the expensive process and the layaways and the lawsuits. Right. So I don't know. But I suppose that goes to one thing, which is, talking about Caltrain, and this is something you touch on too, is the fact other countries that have moved up to a high-speed rail network, they have a public right-of-way system on.
Absolutely.
We don't. And there's issues with Amtrak's relationship to the private right-of-way and the freight network that it runs on, not very well, almost in all cases. And I suppose, what is the public ownership of right-of-way versus what we're doing and what the future is what are the challenges and what are the attitudes we need to look at for this?
I think the number, I'm going to get this wrong, I'm sure, but I think 97% of the right of way that Amtrak operates on is owned by freight railroads.
It's everything but the Northeast Corridor, right?
Yeah, basically. I mean, there's some stuff in Pennsylvania. But right. I mean, whatever, it's a small amount. So it's just because of that, right, as a guest, on these other, networks, and, I don't know how much people know about freight trains, but now they run these 2-mile long trains that they go very slowly. And so it's not so easy to just be hey, pull over to the side so we can zoom by you. It's it's getting the Titanic to do something or just any of these coordination efforts we've been talking about. It's a slow moving process, a slow moving train perhaps. And so it's not so easy to just zoom by, unless there's a siding or some extra track. So the thing is, right, Amtrak is sort of at the mercy of these freight railroads. And going back to the transit work, this is not the case in New York, because currently our subway is independent of all of that. But you talk to people who work on projects in the Midwest or on the West Coast, or in, we talked about the crash wall on the Purple Line, they say the biggest risk is dealing with freight, because they have no incentive to deal with you. One of the things that we've been looking at is Amtrak, the passenger railroad statute, gives them actually quite a lot of authority. And the Secretary of USDOT also has quite a lot of authority. And, they have the right to condemn land. They have the right to, they have to appeal to the Surface Transportation Board for these things. And so it's possible, right, that, they can push their authority in different directions and sort of try to, carve out more right of way that they control. I mean, I think what's cool about California High Speed Rail, right, is that they're developing a lot of right of way that they control and that they own. It is dedicated. There are places where it's blended and mixed, and so it's not perfectly all owned by California High Speed Rail. But I think that it's really exciting. Texas Central, Brightline West, those projects, they're going to own all their rights of way. Brightline in Florida, it doesn't own the right of way anymore, because Brightline, the parent company, sold Florida East Coast to a Mexican company. But they have I think an easement in perpetuity to operate passenger rail within that corridor. But when they built Brightline in Florida, they did own the right of way. And I think owning your right of way, it's like that's freedom. That allows you to do a lot of stuff. And with California High Speed Rail, I think we don't get into this in the report, but I think you can get into some of the original sins. And I think one of them might be trying to hew closely to the existing freight rights of way, because what you find is the freight railroads are very protective and very conservative in terms of when you can do work. And I'm going to get this wrong, I think, but I think you're not allowed to do any construction between November and January, because that's like the high season for moving stuff. And like, they didn't want to have any risk of you messing up, their right of way. And then there's like a whole thing about crash walls, these crossings. Like, if it passed through Shafter, 200 feet, in the other direction, like maybe we don't have to deal with the BNSF at all. But because they're like kind of close, it becomes an issue. Anyhow, I think, the lack of clarity over what we can do on those on our right on the rights of way, creates just like a lot of uncertainty. And no one is really enthusiastic about carving up new rights of way, unless it's like in the median of a highway, which again on the transit side I think is abysmal. Like, that creates terrible transit. For inner city rail, it's fine, like as long as the stops are not in the middle of the highway.
I mean, this is a sin of a lot of the kind of transit projects, is that
Yes.
you don't put the rail where it should be. You put it
Yeah.
where there's a bunch
Right.
of old abandoned rail no one
Yes.
wants, which is like,
Right.
well, that's not where you should put it, but
Right.
like, I mean this is the Henry George program. I mean, this is always kind of the background of things. Land acquisition, it
Yeah.
matters. And
It does,
think
yeah.
I think with this, I mean, it's again, it isn't really quite public right of way, private right of way. Everything, ownership is a bundle of rights. And the
Yep.
Amtrak statute is, it's unusual. And as people point to for years, it's like, yes, the freight, like the statute says the freight should not be slowing
Yes,
down the trains, but no one enforces that. And boy, it's
right.
like, I was on a cross country. If you get a few malfunctions, like you can
Yes.
be a half hour delay can
Yeah.
become a 12 hour
Yeah.
delay. And it has in my case.
Yeah. I love those YouTube videos, by the way. I'm sorry if you were on any of those trains, but
Oh no, I was on the train that went from Chicago to LA right after the train got hit by a garbage truck in Kansas and fell off the tracks. So that was a number of issues that happened there. But no, I think, and like ultimately, all land, it is public in the end, insofar as it is an allodial right by the state, and they can enforce taxation, and that's not even a taking. But I don't even know how right of way taxation works in practice. I've heard people say that the property, like property tax on improvements, has led
that's right.
companies to take away,
Yes,
like to
right of way.
re remove, like a quad track
Yes,
to it. Like,
yes,
what are we doing here? Because we like no one
yes.
benefits from seeing a quad track stop being a
Your
quad
ba your ba
track.
your balance sheet looks better though, and so your stock price goes up.
No, I mean, like so many, it reminds me of like Warner Brothers. Like Zaslav can take a movie, throw it in the trash can, and he makes more money because of tax incentives. Like, well, it sounds like a badly designed tax if somehow
Yes, it
you make
is.
money
Yes.
through destruction instead of creation. But
Yeah.
and as you're mentioning earlier, I mean, yeah, in the statute, like Amtrak, I guess, at least on paper, I mean, at least in the statute,
Yeah, I mean
can't like they can actually balance the lack of improvements by condemning it, or I guess, are there
well,
ways to push back?
condemning freight right of way has not been tested as far as I know.
Okay.
So TBD.
Sure.
But like the DOJ, I believe, filed a suit against Norfolk Southern just a month ago or a couple weeks ago. This is about dispatching and delays and Amtrak's right to operate on its tracks. And so I think we're seeing Because also Amtrak ridership is sort of it's doing kind of well. Like the Northeast Corridor is doing really nicely, but like they launched this Borealis service, it was in Minnesota area that has outperformed by like 3 or 4 times what they anticipated. Amtrak is trying to do, they're involved in this Texas Central project. I think LA San Diego line is like that's a winner, does pretty well. I think ridership has rebounded nicely on a bunch of their services. And so they got a bunch of money in the Biden era. And, there's hope that maybe that will continue in the future. So, I think their fortunes for the first time in 50 years, like looks much better than it ever has. And so the question is like, are they up to the challenge? 'Cause like they have a very ambitious program. Like they're trying to deliver just like a whole host of projects, like new rolling stock, tunnels, bridges, like billions of dollars up and down, on the East Coast specifically. We'll see how it goes.
I wonder
I
too,
don't know.
like, yeah, it's like the federalism whip. How do you crack it if, like, there's just intransigence, which is just irrational? Like, I mean, again, in Ohio, John Kasich just threw away grants to, and you don't, you talk about move fast, move slow. I mean, he delayed the 3C corridor from Cincinnati to Cleveland by 20 years due to personal vendettas or whatever. But like, I don't, I mean, if you have a bad state government, are you, I don't know if like, what could we do the same kind of things we did with like DUI programs or the age tw like age 21, where it's just like, yeah, we can withhold funds. I mean, if you really play with the federal transportation funds and with political courage, you could do a lot. But w what, yeah.
Well, so like, one of the things that it comes up in the report and, is after looking at, so when you get federal money on the transit side, you sign a full funding grant agreement. And in those agreements, it stipulates, like what the money can be used for, how you do all these things. And it's sort of like the document that you go back to be like, am I in fair territory, basically? And there have been instances where there was a project in Oregon. It was in like a extending a light rail to like a very low density area. And they're like, look, we'll give you the money, but you got to rezone your land use. You have to upzone. And it's the first time it's ever happened it was in the 90s, I think. And I think that's a model of like, let's trade federal money for something to improve performance, right? So like, why can't we say California High-Speed Rail, we just gave you $3.5 billion or $3 billion. Brightline West, we just gave you $3 billion. Go buy rolling stock together. Figure it out. Like we're not, it's like you're ordering 10, you're ordering 6, order 16, economies of scale. Like let's jumpstart this industry, get people making these products. I talked to someone at either, I won't say which one, at Brightline West or at California High Speed Rail. It was like, wouldn't have been a bad idea if the federal government had made a requirement like that. And like these people don't like to have any sort of conditions on their money. But what I would say is, like I think we can have conditions around sort of some of the permitting stuff and saying, look, California High Speed Rail, if you want $3 billion, like you need to have a process in place to move through this, local permitting issue in a timely, expeditious manner so that we're not wasting money on this bullshit. I think that's all in bounds. The federal government tends to want to make sure their money is spent legally and on the things that it is says it will spend the money on, which like I understand, but I also think there should be an emphasis on spending its money well, and I don't think there's a lot of emphasis on that.
I think that goes back to like, yeah, it's the issue of what is the interface between the public and private, and money is a quantifiable measure, which is very easy, but like, how do you quantify what is regularly unquantifiable, quality and use and utility. And one, I mean, I neglected to mention before, but you talk about an adjustment for technical merit, and that is done in other nations, not here. But I think looking at something like, it's a lot of projects. Could you, it seems like what the contractors deliver could use a lot more of that. I don't know. But.
Well, I mean, look, and so there's a lot of stuff about like low cost bid, and I've talked to people in the high speed railroad who hate low cost bid because, this Tutor Perini problem that you're talking about where you get a contractor who's like, you know what? I can justify a low cost knowing that I'm gonna change order you to death.
Sure.
And so you don't have as much control over your destiny. Whereas if you have technical merit as part of it, you can say, look, someone who's delivered high speed rail is gonna, and has sort of a pedigree and track record, like they're gonna score higher or be weighted more favorably than a contractor who's never done this before. Going back to our comment about, if I'm hiring a roofer, I want someone who is adept at roofs, not someone who's adept at Excel. And, like that's what internationally on the transit side, that's absolutely how procurement works. Cost is never the dominant piece of the puzzle. Whereas I think in the US, even where you have very, deviations from low cost bid, usually cost is more than 50% of the weight of the in the bidding. So you end up sort of low cost still will win. I think there's this belief that, right, like if you are watching the pennies and accounting for them precisely, which like I think we do that will help, that will get us good projects. But it's like that's not the whole story. There's more to that story
And it's also,
than
you
just being an accountant.
miss the upside of the investment. If you do this right, this really should be money engines for our cities, for our,
Yes,
both the
absolutely.
transit projects for our cities, connecting our cities. In the end, you could make these things and really benefit monetarily. Like it's money to you, not from you, if you do it right. But I don't know. I think just our entire accounting practices never really frame it that way, look at that way, or even kind of cognizant of doing anything but being kind of conservative with our change purse and not much more. So yeah, it's.
And the other thing is that like the US DOT has like a lot of knowledge. Like they know a lot of things that like I remember in the transit work, we found a study from like the 70s about station construction. And it was like mine stations are more expensive. And if you're doing, we have a whole thing about what's known as back of house space. And they talk about like, they looked at stations in a bunch of countries and like have designs and drawings. And like, they have like parametric estimates of what things should cost. And it's like, we already know all this shit. Why we reinvent the wheel every time? And I think that connects with the standards issue, where it's like California High Speed Rail like generated its own standards by reviewing European, East Asian standards and being like, okay, we're going to do something like this. Brightline West did the same thing. Texas Central, they just took the Japanese standards, but it's like, there are these redundancies that like just we know stuff. Like we can say, you know what, like your project would be better if you did this. Like, go do that. And like we're very loath to, trample on a project sponsor in that way. We'll trample on them in a lot of other ways and say, you need more contingency or you need more money or we don't buy this or that. But in terms of like how you make the project better, I don't see a lot of pushback and help. And I've talked to on the transit side to folks who are like, we're paying for, the project has to pay for what's known as a project management oversight consultant. But like they don't actually help the project. They just sort of document things and report back to the FTA. And they're like, it'd be nice to have some help. Like we don't know everything. We've never done this before. Like, tell us what to do.
I guess you talk about kind of what is the theory of how it could change? You say there's talent in the DOTs, across the board. I always feel like to tip the scales, you can do everything from working within. If you talk about training, better trained people, you get better advocates. But I just always wonder, what if couldn't you get a mass movement to change transportation funding first, and then maybe you just kind of retrain? I don't know. It's very hard to find out what the best target for change is, because if you're
Well, I think
on.
it's like it's all, I mean, the thing that's so boring about all this stuff, unfortunately, is like it's all about leadership and it's all about like having a clear mandate of like, we expect excellence. We want to see things done the right way. This is the right way. If you do not do things according to this, like you get shipped out. I think, what you often see in local government is like, actually, the young people are really smart and really good and really passionate and dedicated. And they're just like, they're not nurtured. And so they're just like, screw it. I'm going to go work at consulting firm X, Y, or Z. And, you have people who stick with it, who are those rare birds who just, like you just can't knock them off the course. They're just like the Mother Teresa's of, civil service, I guess. And then you have people who like just understand how to make the system work for them and are not pushing the envelope. They're just, going along to get along. And I think, like that dynamic is demoralizing for a lot of the younger people that come in, bright-eyed and optimistic about this stuff.
Yeah, I think the dance between idealism and materialism. Yeah, there's somewhat. In the end, yeah, things change, but how fast? But we've been going very, very long. I think it's a good leaving off point. But any final words or anything we didn't really touch on or.
No, I mean, look, I think, we hit on a lot of things. There are things in the report that we didn't talk about, modal networks and what local experimentation looks like, or the corridor ID program. I think the way you prefaced the section five about the regulations you create shape the outcomes, I didn't take the bait as much as I would have liked to, because I think it's actually very important. I was there's some other thing, but I think a lot of it is, maybe I'm like a 1970s structuralist or whatever, but I do think that the structure of the programs has a lot to do with the outcomes that we get. And, in the report, I think very bluntly, we argue that, the project, the goal is to get through NEPA so you can get your federal funding. And so you design a project that can get through NEPA and get federal funding.
Yeah.
You don't design a project that is constructible. And I
Exactly.
think, that is probably the biggest problem. You need, California High School is a really good example of this, where, that first construction package, like they didn't deal with like the utilities effectively, because like they don't create a huge environmental impact that is going to, slow you down. So you're just kind of like, we'll solve that problem after we get the federal funding. And that's what they did. They did not solve the problem well as
Yeah.
a result. And you see it with like every transit project. Same, they all make the exact same mistake, where you go through preliminary engineering, and then it's like once you get your funding, you just do it all over again for constructability, not for getting through all the different hoops you have to get through. And I think that like that is important feedback to recognize that like that's just wasting money, right? Like
Yeah.
that's stupid. It has taken me a really long time to sort of identify and figure that out, because like I look at these transit projects, I'm like, why did they spend $100 million on preliminary engineering and then basically do the same thing again in final design? Like, shouldn't it be like more of a seamless handoff between one to the other?
Yeah.
And what I found is that it's not seamless. Like, you have to redo all the preliminary engineering, and then you have to do the final design. And so like your final design bill ends up being like five, six, seven times bigger than your preliminary engineering bill, which is not a small bill to begin with. So I think the way we do planning is quite bad. I mean, I think we talked about it in a bunch of different ways. But I think, there's some hope out there anyway. But this has been great. This has been really
Yeah.
interesting. I'm glad.
Yeah,
I'm glad we
thanks for
talked
making all the
for however
time.
long we've talked.
quite a bit. We have been talking to Eric Goldwyn all about transit costs. You can listen to this episode, part one, or any other episode of this radio program at the website cthecat.org. This is a presentation of KZSU, Stanford.